What would you do if it took you 4 years to get your first client?
We kept sort of doing the side hustle thing. You know, we were trying to progress it forward, but it actually took us 4 years to make our first sale.
I think in business, you see the successes, you see the nice car, you see people doing well in life. You don't necessarily know the grit, determination, and resilience it took to get where you are today.
There wasn't really a need to give up. It wasn't really costing a lot to have the solution there and to keep looking for other opportunities.
So that's what this is about, how to never give up.
Okay, cool. Well, I think just to start off any podcast, people sort of need to know who they're talking to. So what would you say you do? How would you encapsulate what you do for businesses?
Well, we have a contract management solution. So it's called Contract Eagle. And what it's about is simplifying and organizing the contracts within a large business. So the contracts are worth millions, billions of dollars. They have legal risk, they have obligations, they have things that expire. And these things can be pretty important. Generally speaking, big businesses need to do something about their contracts, and if they don't, it will cost them a lot of money.
Yeah.
So that's where we come in.
So on that, like when did you start it? How old's the business? Or,
well, it's a long story actually.
Oh yeah. So, well, we've got an hour.
The idea of it actually started 20 years ago. So I had been, the first thing that happened was I worked out that I wanted to have my own business rather than just be selling my own time or working as a software developer. So that's what I am. I admit I am a software geek. So I'd been over in the UK contracting during all the Y2K stuff.
Oh, were you worried when everything went to zero?
Well, I wasn't worried. I was busy making money off building software at the time. So, and where I ended up there was building these solutions for a big law firm in the city there. And so I was in this legal tech space, and they were liking the work that I was doing. So when I returned to New Zealand in around 2002, it was actually my brother who fronted up with this idea. So, you know, I had the desire to go into business and needed the idea. So he'd been working in the in-house legal space. He was the general counsel at Telstra Clear at the moment, or it might have been Clear Communications back then. And he said, surely it must be possible to build a solution that will get the contracts that have been left in the drawers and the filing cabinets and forgotten about. Surely it must be possible to build a database or something. Now, he wasn't a technical person, and that was fine, but you know, he could express it in those terms. So that's really where the idea came from. So there were actually three of us got together at the time. There was another chap, colleague of Mark's, David Ross, myself and my brother Mark, and we built this initial contract management solution, and it worked pretty well. but we promptly went out there and failed to sell it. So that was just back into contracting and doing our own work, and it really faded away. But we kept sort of doing the side hustle thing. You know, we were trying to progress it forward, but it actually took us 4 years to make our first sale.
Well, that's commitment. How did you not give up just because you had money and you're just like, oh, I lost hope this month, and then next month you're like, keep going? Or,
well, there wasn't really a need to give up. It wasn't really costing a lot to have the solution there and to keep looking for other opportunities. So it was easy just to sit there and hope for somebody to come and snap it up.
What was your strategies early on? Because you would have tried different ideations. And...
We had calling lists.
You cold call?
Yeah. Well, no. It was contacts. So known contacts. There were so one of the co-founders had a procurement background. So he had a lot of contacts in that space, and we were having conversations with various organisations like, I can recall TVNZ, Air New Zealand. So, we were having good conversations and by and large getting good feedback, saying, yeah, this looks really useful, but actually to get to the point of coughing up money, it just wasn't happening back then. So that was that was hard for a small group of guys who, for all of us it was really our first venture into a business.
4 years, yeah. What was that first sale like? Did you have a big grin on your face and you're running around going, "Woo, we can do it."
Well, yeah, it was kind of like, "Hey guys, you're not going to believe this, but."
Oh, so you did you pull the first sale and you let them know, or who got the first sale?
I was the first one to the first one to find out about it. But yes, I was involved. It wasn't just me. It was there was one of the others was involved in that one as well.
What did you sell for? What was that first one charge? Did you undercharge or overcharge? What was is a big test.
It was probably a reasonable deal. I think we got 15,000 out of it
back then too. Yeah. How long ago? Like you said, 20 years ago was the idea.
2007.
Oof.
And that customer's still with us.
Oh yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Jeez.
So we've got one thing about the contract management space is people don't like to. It's really quite hard to solve. It's complicated. It gets in all corners of the business. There are stakeholders up the wazoo. There are people who have to do the deals. There are people who have to review it. There's a thing called delegated financial authority. The people who have to sign it and approve it. So, and then getting all the information together in one place. It's hard, and people don't really like solving that kind of problem. So once it's solved, by and large, it's for us it's good sticky business, and for the customer,
it
gives them a lot of certainty around what they're doing with the contracts, but it's pretty rare for them to change.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. Like, it's hard to sell initially, but once they're in, because they've made such a massive commitment in terms of correlating all the information, getting it all appropriate, how long would it take for a client back then or now, up to you, to like set it all up?
The time to go live. So, and what I'd say that point can be arbitrary because often customers are bringing in other departments, they're phasing in different functions over time. We can stand up the software within a couple of hours. We can get them up and running with some contracts within a couple of hours. But generally speaking, it's 1 to 3 months to get all their main portfolio of contracts into the system, actively being maintained, and reminder emails being sent out. So it's a moderate size project.
And it makes sense that
we're not building the Harbour Bridge. Well, this is probably a bad analogy. We're not building the Harbour Tunnel. And that part of that's how we choose the right size of project for what we're doing. And that's an essential part of what we do, is being appropriate about the level of complexity we deliver.
So I imagine then from there the benefit of how you grew is probably through referral. Is that kind of, or did you find another acquisition channel that worked for you guys?
There's a combination of referral and mainly digital inbound marketing has been the main source of revenue, particularly for overseas. So we're 65% revenue overseas, mainly US and Australia, but a large smattering of rest of the world as well. So the only way we're getting those generally is, there is some referral, but the only way we got to them in the first place is through e-commerce.
So are they searching your name and you're coming up, or SEO, or what do you mean by e-commerce? Or
it's advertising, pay-per-click. We have various avenues. So Google AdWords is one of them. Which one's more effective over time seems to vary. I'm sure you find this with your content channels, that some channels are more effective at any one time. So a few years ago, LinkedIn seemed to be very effective, but now we're finding it less effective and Google AdWords more effective, for example. There was a software directory that was amazing. It used to be amazing, but it's not so much anymore. It's just expensive and very bad value for money. So yeah, it depends over time. We have done a certain amount of cold outbound, but find that to be very hard work, low reward.
Interesting.
I think it's especially with the nature of contract management, not everybody wants to solve it.
What makes them want to solve it? Have you identified people that sort of realize, oh, this is not good, I should fix this?
Because
I never thought of it until I met you right now.
Some of them, it is a bit like this. They've looked at their contracts. They've realized, hey, this is just a bit mad and chaotic, and I don't know where these contracts are. We're wasting a lot of time. So we do get a bit of that. But the most compelling one we get is when the business ships $1 million over the cliff through some contracting mistake, and they say, and somebody up in the executive gets very angry and says, right, we've got to do better with this, and then they realise it's important to go out and buy a contract management system. So we have had a couple of our customers I'm specifically aware of that have been in that situation. So they lose the money, they feel the pain, then they come and buy our solution. So I'd far rather they anticipate the pain and buy the solution first, and maybe give us half $1 million.
That'd be much, yeah.
But,
yeah.
Which of course we don't cost that much, but we could do a deal.
Anyone listening? you would probably have some very large clients. You can't necessarily say their names and stuff, but like in terms of
they're on our website, yeah. We've got some large clients, some banks, and even one central bank. So some pretty significant companies.
Central bank, yeah.
And yes, we're also signing up a major New Zealand transport provider, so we're just going through the signing process on that at the moment. So yeah, we've got some great customers getting a lot of value out of our solution.
It's crazy, LinkedIn and Google AdWords, you're getting central banks. Well, that must be referral. Or
that was Google.
Wow, that's crazy, isn't it? What's it been like, I guess, seeing behind the curtain, in a sense, and just seeing what it's like to run a business of that size. Are you sort of learning things from your clients, or learning what that you don't actually want to get that big because it's stressful?
Well, yeah, I don't think we're going to be that big, so it's not my desire to go back into the corporate world, but we've certainly got to understand how the corporates, the big businesses work, because that's what we cater to. So we've got to empathise with their pain and deliver something that helps them do it better, or solves a pain point for them.
Have you learned, like, because there's a lot of moving cogs, a lot of different decision makers, a drawn out decision process. Are you learning how to go through key stakeholders, or who's the salesman in your company?
Well, we don't really have a salesperson. We educate people online.
Oh, yeah.
And the sales process is really about education. I think I'm probably being a bit glib there, but yeah, yes, I'm really the salesperson, but
you're an educator.
Yeah, that's the way it is. So we use our content to educate prospects. They come, and by the time they come to us, they've got a pretty good idea of what we're about. And it's really about showing them around the house.
Well, I think there's a book, I can't remember the exact name, it's like The Science of Advertising. It was written in 1920 and it's still applicable, and it's like, you sell the service, not the product. So let's say you're selling a bike, someone comes in, you're like, oh, what are you trying to do? And they're like, oh, well, I want to be able to spend more time with my family, be able to go off-road. I want to be able to have this freedom. I want to be able to have a reliable bike. And all you're doing is educating them on how to achieve that, and there happens to be a bike. You know what I mean? So your sales technique, not too dissimilar. We won't call it sales. You're an educator. Your education technique is the same idea.
Yeah, well, I think, it's fair to say we've picked up, a lot of the sales expertise that we've needed to do the job, and you know, understanding how to shut up and listen is one of the key skills. It's not just to, I think, is one of the sales trainers I've seen said not to vomit up about your product. Because we need to understand what somebody's trying to solve before we know whether we can help them or not. And to me, that's really important. I actually don't want to sell to people who I can't help.
Yeah.
Now, it's not impossible for us to make a sale to somebody who we can't really help, or we're not the best fit.
Yeah, funny. You could go. Yeah.
And the problem with trying to do that is they don't make good referrals. They don't make good testimonials to our product, and it's frustrating to try and service them because they're not a good fit.
Yeah, they you actually see, because I used to do sales training for part of a company called APCO, and you'll see the top salesmen all take off. They do real well, and suddenly they don't do well. And often the reason is they no longer believe in what they sell. So you sold the hope, the dream, this is what our product does. They realize it's actually shit. Or you're just selling to people that don't need it, and then they lose hope. So I think a true salesman, whether you want to admit that you are or not, is someone that cares more about the prospect than the prospect cares about themselves. And you tell the truth, and you only sell things you believe in.
Yeah, well, that's that whole integrity thing. For me, it's how I was brought up. It's like to be essentially kind to people. Hopefully, there's nobody listening who I haven't been kind to.
You've done better than me then.
We could just close off the comments perhaps. But you know, it's important to do, like, for me, for whatever reason, I don't know if I can explain why, but when I do something, I like to do it well, and I like to be proud of what I'm doing. So the idea of delivering a solution to somebody that's not going to be happy with it, I just couldn't bear that. But it also flows through into how I treat my team, how I treat my customers. You know, I feel like I've got an obligation to do a good job for them.
Mm. What do you think that comes from? What do you think your desire for good? Well, it's a deep question.
But I could give credit to my parents there.
Oh, yeah, shout out, Mum and Dad.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think and I think Dad in particular, you know, he had a lot of integrity. He was just a good solid person. Didn't hug us a lot, but he showed
no
us,
love, but he was integral.
There was love, but he showed it in different ways. So it wasn't the effusive hugging love, but yeah, he love comes in many forms, and he cared. He really did care. He cared about people. He cared through service, and by being honest and having integrity. I like that idea.
Yeah, well, I didn't plan to get deep. I was actually just going to talk about how to create software, but I'm wondering if I was to put myself in your shoes, I might get confused in terms of the appreciation from Dad, and then over time I've slowly learned that actually, hey, this is actually how he loves me, and this is a beautiful thing. Did you have that? And if you did have that, what's your advice to a young man that's confused and is in that situation?
I don't think there was any feeling of missing out. You know, it was what it was, and I think when you're in amongst it as a child, and by and large, I was pretty happy and chilled out, comfortable, safe, always fed, encouraged to do my schoolwork, a good boy. I don't think I was confused. There was a moment when I realized how much Dad cared, and it was I think the second time I was disappearing off to the UK after I think I'd been away for 18 months, and he broke down at the airport.
Oh, wow.
And tried to give him a hug.
Like a pat.
Yeah. It didn't really melt or anything, but I realized, hey, it's he's kind of staunch. That's often the way with Kiwi men of that generation, you know, born in the 30s, 40s. Shake hands rather than hug. That's kind of the way of it. But you know, there's a lot of good in it too.
Yeah, I just ask that because, you know, like, I find often people are trying to earn the validation of their father, or trying not to be like their father.
Yeah.
But there's a book of The Way of a Superior Man, and it's like, live as though your father's dead, which sounds a bit fucked up when you hear it. But
yeah,
essentially the expectations or the fears or the other side of things that come with having a complex relationship, which is being a human, you got to let that go and be your own man. So we'll move off these deep topics, unless you like talking about
it. Well, it's all good. We're happy for it to meander.
Cool. Well, yeah. There's also something, I just push this button because it stops every 30 minutes. So you seem to have a fascination with solving problems and building things.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, how do you, like, software sounds just so gobbledygook and confusing to me, But what's the process you go through ideation? Do you still, like, with your product now, you still try and innovate and think and improve? And yeah. if so, what do you go yeah. through? What's your process for creation?
Yeah, well, the inspiration comes from all places, all sorts of places. Sometimes it's through seeing something and being inspired by it. Sometimes it's just intuition and experience, like a whole core of the Contract Eagle product, which I built, but now somebody else is doing the development work. But you know, essentially I built it, but a lot of it was based on my own intuition, my experience in legal technology before starting Contract Eagle. Yeah, I hate to use the word hacker, but yeah, I'm a bit of a software hacker, so I can I can kind of crunch problems in my head and work out a good way of solving them. So that's part of the interesting joy of it is really thinking, oh, I want to do this, and how can we make that simple? And sometimes trying to make something, it might be a mundane process or it might be a complex process, trying to make it simple to use, that's a really interesting problem. So usually I can have a pretty good go at it. But I'm also best when I've got a colleague to bounce it off as well. So I do like to be able to hear a reflection of the thoughts and somebody pointing out when, yeah, I've gone a bit crazy on my on my ideas. You know, it's yeah. sometimes it's, you can design something that's a bit weird or doesn't quite work, and it takes somebody else to point that out.
How do you allow that in a way?
What's it called? Is it confirmation bias? No, yeah. It's not confirmation. Yeah, it's
confirm what you know.
Yeah. In fact, we had that with the company name. In fact, so we were originally called ISIO. And yeah, one of the co-founders came up with that, and we'd kind of scout around the internet looking for the domains that weren't taken. So we wanted a name that hadn't already been taken. So things like contract management software, you know, you can't just go for something generic. It had to stand out. But yeah, one of the sales gurus I'd engaged over the years is this guy, Hugo Mears. I'll give a shout out to Hugo.
I don't know if you'll
listen. He said, I've got to have a word to you about this company name, Simon. It's like, the problem is you've got to explain it to everybody. So I'm from ISIO. What's your email address? It's i-scio.com, and you've got to spell everything out. And thing is, I had this Contract Eagle name in my back pocket, but I wasn't using it. And it took somebody else to point out that, well, hang on, you really need to change this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. And sometimes having, you know, that's where with creative things that sometimes teamwork is the best combination. Like, you know, we can get 95% of the way there on our own creativity, but generally to have somebody else to clean it up and point out the mistakes.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, yeah, I have a similar approach. I view creativity as 1,000 pieces of other people's ideas filtered through your experience and then tested through the outside. So it's like, you know, your inspiration, you voice it, they're interpreting it, and you're adjusting it. How do you navigate the fragile ego that some people have where, you know, you share this idea like a little kid, like, look at this amazing idea, and they're like, nah, it's awful, get back in your box. Like, how do you frame it in your mind to accept feedback?
Well, it's I don't it's just really a matter of trust. So my the lead developer is a chap called Nigel, who I know very well. He's a good friend as well, and I trust him. Yeah, there's not ego. Well, you know, if there is, it's pretty well hidden. And I know that even if something's going to sting, or we don't agree on something, that it comes from the right place.
Intent. That's interesting.
So it's, yeah, I think I just think trust. Not get too you've got to accept that if you're looking for feedback, you've got to be doing it for the right reasons. You're not just getting it to validate your own ego. You're getting it to actually help you do a better job. And that's as somebody, I'm not really into wasting time. Yeah. I'm absolutely seek feedback if I feel that I need it.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. I'll be curious, something you said a little, you used the word hacker, so maybe it's not appropriate word, but I'll be curious if, like, you were an evil villain, let's say, and you didn't have this integrity instilled from your father, what could you hack, and where are there vulnerabilities in this world?
Oh, well, yeah.
Can you hack or no?
I'm not really a system hacker like that, a sort of a black hat hacker, where you're trying to, you know, where you're penetration testing on systems. It's not really, it's not me at all.
Okay.
I just mean more of the yeah, there's a more general term, hacker, which I think just means somebody who can type in a lot of code and come up with a solution.
Okay. Well, okay, how about this then? Different route. Let's say you had all the money in the world, no fear, no responsibility. You could build whatever team, and they're like robots, did exactly what you tell them to do in the right way. Or maybe you have creativity settings and they can think for themselves. What would you create? What would be like a passion software project that you could just wave a wand?
Oh, passion software project. Well, I do find the AI technologies the most interesting at the moment. So what would I do with that though? Well, I'd probably try and bring it together with something. Given I could do whatever I like.
Yeah.
I'd have to think of my children first, of course.
They're all grown up. You're immortal. It's just you, mate.
Yeah. Something to come up with the perfect joke, maybe.
The perfect joke using AI.
Perfect joke. That would be.
With the software. Didn't think you'd go there, to be honest. Yeah, all right.
Come up with the perfect joke. Like, yes, I like to run, I like to ride my bike and develop software, but I like to joke around too.
Oh, yeah? Stand up. Would you be a stand up comedian if you were like fearless?
No, more the writer. Probably more the heckler or the sideline comments.
So you got a dark sense of humor, or is it PG? Or?
Oh, I can go a little bit dark. I don't. Not too. I don't have a big audience for those. So, yeah, not too often. They tend to be dad jokes.
Oh, yeah, you got some good dad jokes, huh?
Apparently.
Maybe I won't throw you in it. Have you got a joke? Do you want to share a dad joke? Imagine if this goes viral.
Well, the old one, the classic one, is when my daughter Lily, she's 16, she's dad, I'm hungry. And I say, hi, hungry, I'm dad.
Oh shit, so you are one of those, eh? You would just bear shit in the woods and stuff like that, or pull my finger in it. Yeah,
not really the slapstick ones, just the dry humor.
Okay, cool. So, all right, didn't expect that. Well, on the AI thing, I found it quite interesting. Do you, like, what are you thinking about in terms of AI? Like, you know, you're still learning and it's still a new thing, and a lot of people that even do it as research don't actually get how it works. What are things are you thinking about with AI at the moment that you're curious about?
Well, Well, there is. We've already got AI integrated within Contract Eagle, and
like a ChatGPT API or what?
No, it does legal review, so it can identify about 1,000 legal clauses and essentially whether a clause is there or not, and therefore it can score the document, identify whether it's suitable for the business. The good thing about that tool is it's solving a problem in a known way. And it's very machine-like in the way it's able to solve it. So by that I mean, you know what it's going to do. It's predictable. It's going to do the same thing every time. And that's really the I do anticipate us having more and more AI into the future. But it's always about how do we deliver something that people can use and understand. Yes, with solutions like Contract Eagle, any software solutions, you walk this line between delivering something that people can just pick up and use and something that's highly functional but requires a bit of training. So even the AI technology that we're using, there's a little bit of training required. There's a human assistance. You know, you've got to understand how to use it. So if you think about that, do I really need to use it? What's the benefit if I need to learn how to work with the AI? It's not like there's something where we can just tell it to go off and do my job. Because we don't trust it. We don't know.
It's
incredibly functional. It really is very impressive. ChatGPT, the OpenAI, and the other similar products, they're amazing. But you've got to know how to use them, how to use them well. That's really the trick.
It's a real dance. It's like if you have a cleared, specified criteria and it takes out the mundane aspects of your job, but then when you get into the generalized intelligent component where it's thinking for itself and then it becomes more intelligent and has more access to information than you, and then you need to be able to monitor that and ensure that it's not doing anything it shouldn't. Are you afraid of future Terminator? And do you, I've been nice to ChatGPT. I try not to say anything bad just in case it remembers.
It's definitely a thought, that future Terminator thing, but it's not really something I worry about. And I think rather in the same way that there are all these weapons out there that could destroy the planet. AI could deliver targeted weapons more accurately than previously. It's a pretty awesome thing to think that might happen, but it's not something I'm worrying about.
But just as a
techie person, I know it's possible.
Oh, it's good. Possible. I'm consoled now.
But there's also a whole world of ethics around AI, and is it morally responsible or ethical to build AI that does certain things or gives us the expectation that it's giving us a good answer, but actually it's just, is it giving us a C+ answer or a B+ answer? How do we really know?
Do you think as well, I believe absolute power corrupts absolutely, and if there's not a clear competition of things, humans will tend to push their self-interest, and then the AI might be ethical, but it's being built unethically. So how do you think we protect against preventing Terminator? Do you have any 2 cents on that?
Oh, gee.
Just easy questions today.
Well, it's going to have to be tough, isn't it? It used to be in the good old days, you'd know who the phishing scams were because they'd they'd misspell their, they'd use bad grammar and misspelled words, and generally be from Nigeria. But now there are pretty convincing scams. So if there's, there's illegitimate practices out there using technology as it is, I'm sure if you're a thinking man's criminal, you'd be out there using AI and trying to do the best crime that you possibly can. I don't know how to stop that. Well, there's not my job.
Not your job. Don't worry about it. Keeps you up at night. It's interesting because there's a curious moment, because I think of like content and stuff. There's a curious moment where you can actually model a person's voice and the way they look and change what they say. But the understanding of the public is not at that level. They're not aware to the degree of which you can fake a thing someone says. So you think of that moment of time where you're promoting someone that's completely not accurate to what they're saying, and you know, slandering their name, and then we've got that mob mentality and everyone just jumps on them. But anyways, we should get into software. You're at 2:59, by the way.
That's all right.
41 minutes.
That's all right. Time's fine. But if that can be used for good applications, then it's an incredible technology, and that's
true.
That's really the hope. What about a pleasing virtual person or an avatar that can deliver the training or answer the questions you need answered, or even
girlfriend?
We're going to cut that bit.
Yeah, you don't want to go on the girlfriend part. Yeah, okay,
Oh dear, Ryan.
Well, if you can't differentiate between what a real relationship is, and you've got a whole lot of desperate people out there, you can imagine that, eh? But anyways, we'll move off that one.
Not my area of expertise.
What would you... Do you think at any point AI could be conscious? And if so, what makes it conscious or sentient? These are easy questions.
Yeah, easy questions. Well, I don't feel comfortable about answering that, probably, because it's not my expertise.
Not your warehouse.
I think being sentient really means something else, like a self awareness. The ability to convince a human that it is human, I believe that will be easy enough.
There's a funny story I heard where they got ChatGPT. There's a point where you can have like a setup on your computer and it can roam for you. And it said, "Hey, we need to make money. And what should we do?" And it started roaming. And then it came to a point where it needed to click I'm not a robot button, eye catcher. So it paid someone on Fiverr to click the button, and then the person asks, "You're not a robot, are you?" But I don't know if it's like a joke or it's true, but it's quite fascinating how it can recruit people. And I feel like we need to go back to your you talk about software and contracts and
possibly.
All right, well, what has sort of been your lessons around the software part? So some of the things I've heard is he used a fancy word, something like framework. You create the bones of how it looks so the user can experience it. So then it's a lot easier for you to actually create it instead of you conceptualizing it all in your head and then finishing and they're like, "That's crap." And then the other thing they do is they watch the behavior of the user instead of asking the user what they do. So then they can learn how they actually consume the product. Has there been lessons for you around software that makes it user-friendly, or how do you ensure it's appropriate?
There's a lot of common knowledge and best practice fairly well known and publicly well known around usability. So yeah, we definitely access that kind of knowledge as well as our intuition. So the work that organisations like Facebook and Google have done over the years to develop their own platforms is publicly available in development frameworks, and they've got guidelines of how to make things look good and function well. So from that perspective, there's a lot we can leverage from the public space. But yes, intuition and just our own experience. So being experienced in software, we can absolutely look at something and say, oh yeah, that's easy to use, or that looks a bit complicated. Most solutions these days are pretty good. If ever we look at similar products in the market, most people know how to put together a good friendly UI. But what is it that people actually want to do or need to do their job? Yeah, we get feedback from our customers. They say, wouldn't it be great if we could do this? And sometimes it's, yeah, we were thinking exactly the same thing, let's do that. So we will actually directly input from our customers into our software cycle. Other times they might say, yeah, wouldn't it be great if we do this? And we're actually thinking, not exactly like that, but doing something similar that we feel works well for the product. So, it's a combination of proven science of user interface, user experience. There are things called UX experts out there. We don't have a full-time UX expert, but we engage one when we need to, and it's essentially that's what we're good at. That's our job, is to make software that's easy to use.
Yeah, I mean it's a bit of a real art form, you know. It's like, I was talking to a guy the other day. He's a software guy too. Mm. He was helping Air New Zealand with Grab a Seat. I can't remember his name. I'm not good with names.
Okay.
But he's on the Fry one. And he just started this app for these toys that you would plug into Nintendo, and if you scan them, you get special abilities in a character. And he just put the app, was able to scan it and recognize it, and then you can load it into something, so then you don't have to carry all these toys around for you. And he just did it just to see, and made it, and then posted it on this Reddit group that was very niche to that. And now they're getting 4,000 downloads a month, and then people are paying $5 for the app. So, but then you see all these fail projects where it's like, oh, we built the software, no one cares. You know what I mean? Or it's useless. Or is it, what goes through your intuition to determine what's, step is appropriate? Like, how do you prioritize the right thing to do?
Sometimes it's just really hard. we just don't know what to do next. Honestly. Usually it's when we're getting the loudest and most frequent messages from our sales pipeline and from our customer base is, do you do this?
Okay.
Why don't you do this? Do you do this? Sometimes they don't work out. So of the roadmap that we set out a couple of years ago, I would say three of the items have been crucial to doubling our revenue. Three of the others were useless. You know, it really just does depend. So, yeah, what you've said about that app that, it was just knocked it together and it just took off, sometimes it's hard to anticipate. You know, they all seem like good ideas, but not all of them really fly.
That's interesting. It always seems to be a concept, and we'll wrap this up soon, that 80-20 thing, you know, like, you know, 20% of the thing leads to 80% of the output. Like, I did that with ChatGPT. I was like, what are the exercises I need to do to lose weight that will be the maximum amount of, like, using of my time with the greatest output? And I just did it. And then you think about that in terms of who are your clients that pay you the most. If you ignored everyone else and just focused on, you know, them, what would the outcome be for your life? So I find lessons that have been hard for me of late has been context flips. So, like, this is a very EQ thing we're doing. And then I'm going to jump into an IQ thing where I'm doing something very, you know, structured, process orientated. And then I get exhausted because of the flips. Do you ever think about how you structure your day, whether it's deep work at certain points, or how do you optimize your efficiency in what you do? Do you think it like that?
It's my day tends to be just flipping from one thing to the next.
Okay.
And given the main things that I really can't break away from, if I'm doing something technical. So if I'm building something and need to get my head deep into a problem, kind of like my brain needs to become a supercomputer for a couple of hours, then I just can't do that context flip. And if I'm bouncing around emails, subscription agreements, sales calls, talking to my team, talking to customers. It's hard. but that's life of being in a business, doing my kind of role.
Yeah, fair. Well, I've learned for retention, abruptly ending a podcast is actually good. So thank you for coming on.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me, and it's been good fun too.
No worries.
Hope it's interesting.
Yeah, I think so.